You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. Welcome to Brookings. My name is Bruce Jones. I'm the Vice President and the Director for Foreign Policy, and it's a pleasure to welcome you for today's event, co-organized by our Center for the United States in Europe, together with our long-standing partner, the Turkish Industry and Business Association, TÜSİAD. TÜSİAD is a key institutional partner for us, and their support and their collaboration over a number of years has been instrumental to making our Turkey work possible. And I'm delighted to be joined by several friends from colleagues from TÜSİAD today, most importantly, their CEO, Bahadur Kalasu. Thank you so much for being here today. TÜSİAD is not only our partner, but a very influential voice in Turkey's private sector and one of the most prominent civil society organizations in Turkey, with a long track record of supporting participatory democracy and a competitive market economy, issues which are, of course, crucial to the debate about Turkey's future right now. Their mission, I believe, in many ways mirrors our own and our values, and so it's a natural partnership, and I'm also extraordinarily grateful to TÜSİAD for their constant respect for our independence and recognizing that the value of Brookings is in the independence of its scholars, and their respect to that is much appreciated. Today's discussion is going to examine the evolving dynamics of Turkey, Europe, and the United States and the relations between them. For the United States, Turkey has been a close ally and a strategic partner for 7 decades, and for a long period of time, widely considered to be a model of a rising, modern, democratic, Muslim-majority country and ally. Of course, now Turkey finds itself in a very difficult period and a challenging neighborhood and dealing with instability on all flanks. In recent years, the success of Turkey's economic rise and the structural reforms in the early 2000s made huge progress, but I think have been countered now by a number of more significant negative developments, including weakening of the rule of law and deteriorating democratic process. And today, with the country's EU accession process in profound question, I think, and its transatlantic commitments and liberal democratic credentials in question as well, we appear to be in a place where Turkey looks to be altering its orientation away from the West. It's not the only country doing that. One of the things that we are watching in the international system, fueled by economic uncertainty, fueled by migration, fueled by fear of terrorism, fueled by questions about the balance of power, a number of countries are beginning to look at alternatives to the West in their models, both in terms of commitments to the rule of law and in terms of where they look for international support. And we've seen that across in elections across Europe to differing degrees in both Central and Western Europe, and not Europe alone. All of this at a time when there are tensions in the relationship between the United States and Turkey, most notably around issues in the Middle East, in particular differences over Syria, PKK, and related issues. Despite all of this, it seems to me that the United States and Europe still have huge strategic interests in continuing their effort to keep Turkey anchored in a Euro-Atlantic community of shared values and interests. This is a tricky and difficult time for that, but of no less importance as a result. It's a case, by the way, made very eloquently and very passionately in an important new book by Kemal Kirishi, our TÜSİAD senior fellow here at Turkey, and who will join us on stage shortly, who has just published this, Turkey and the West, Fault Lines in a Troubled Alliance, which strikes me as an awfully timely and well-crafted book. And Kemal will speak to these issues on the panel today. Before I turn things to the moderator, I want to invite TÜSİAD CEO Bahadur to offer a few introductory remarks and to, again, express my appreciation and thanks to you and your team. So with that, Bahadur.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your time today being with us. 10 years past, Ambassador. 10 years past since the launch of the Brookings TÜSİAD program. Since 2013, we have enlarged the scope of the program to constitute the US-Turkey program. the Brookings Turkey project, under the coordination of Professor Kemal Kirishci, is productive with panels, analysis, publications that stimulated debates on topics of relevance to U.S.-Turkish and transatlantic relations. The independent and bipartisan thinking and debate at Brookings are crucial for the success of the program. I extend my thanks to all our colleagues in Brookings for their impressive intellectual and organizational contributions. Today, we will discuss common challenges encountered by Turkey, the EU, the U.S., with specific focus on the future of international order and globalization. Well, as the fourth industrial revolution begins to take hold around the planet, the process of societal change and democracy are going through stages of fluctuation, as was the case in every other industrial revolution. The first one triggered the democracy of taxpayers, the second one democracy of people, the third one of the middle class, and now the question is interesting and open. This 4.0 version of industry and technology and society is being quickly uploaded into our daily lives. But there is an algorithmic problem with coding the dynamics of a new, sustainable, and inclusive development, thus of a better democracy. The dialectic evolution that we are in, unfortunately, has several adverse dimensions as well as beneficial ones. Innovations like quantum computing, artificial intelligence, Internet of Things, biotechnologies, renewable energies, they all have the potential to lead to smarter lives, smarter cities, smarter government, to more transparency, direct democracy, and public security. However, the globalization's perceived velocity by many people triggered a sense of economic insecurity, enhanced by social polarization and post-truth political debate. Any items in the list of remedies from inclusive growth to better governance remain too conceptual for the taste of an increasingly populistic public debate. And our topic of today is certainly affected by this. As to SIAD, we have been living the last 10 years also in ups and downs. In the last year of Turkish history, as a business community, we have been coming to the foreground of the public debate, asking for, as usual, but with change, of course, substance, more and better democracy in Turkey, better economy, and better relations with the West, and particularly with the European Union. Better democracy for us is a really well-functioning constitutional order with separation of powers, zero prisoners of opinion or politicians under the pressure of the judiciary system, and also, and certainly, a country of freedoms, thanks to which we can be a country of democracy, but also creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship, and social responsibility. European Union process is very important in this respect. We know that future of Europe debate is very important also for Turkey's future within the Western world and also, well, in the European geography. A geography that is likely to be determined more and more by a variable geometry concerning circles of integration, multi-speed Europe with different circles, eventually maybe, of course, with a core Europe, federal European zone, surrounded by a confederal larger circle where Turkey also can find its place, provided that it fulfills the criteria of the of democracy of the European Union, but also alignment with the single market rules. Many problems are also valid on the relations with the United States of America. The U.S.-Turkish relationship has also sunk to a new low point. Differences in priorities and threat perceptions in Syria, disputes over multiple judicial cases in both countries, in addition to the deterioration of Turkey's image here in Washington, and anti-Americanism in Turkey have weakened ties. However, the historical perspective is important. It has been 150 years since Turkey dispatched its first ambassador to Washington. As Kemal Kirishi writes in his forthcoming book, it has been over 70 years since USS Missouri sailed into Istanbul, signaling Turkey's entry into the emerging Western alliance. Since then, this relationship has endured dramatic ups and downs, but has always recovered. That is because a strong partnership serves the national interests of Turkey and the United States and strengthens the larger transatlantic alliance. The recent decision over the issuance of non-immigrant visa demonstrates that any one of the disputes in the relationship could quickly escalate into a real crisis. Therefore, the resolution of these disagreements has become more urgent. There is unfortunately mutual mistrust and even a degree of mutual contempt in Washington and Ankara that needs to be overcome. Strong political will, which appears to be absent in both capitals at present, is required to be reloaded as a genuine partnership. The situation is not sustainable, and therefore the business and policy communities need to encourage leaders, policymakers, and legislators to continue engagement, to try to compartmentalize at least some of the disagreements for the time being, and to seek compromise on the others. This must be done in recognition of the essential nature of this relationship and the fact that it is too big to fail. It is too important to fail, too important for the interests of the US and Turkish citizens, too important for the Western values and interests in that geography where Turkey has a central role in this Euro-Asian axis, too important to fail for the Western values. Thank you very much.
Let me start by welcoming you all to today's conference. I'm Kemal Kirishci, the Senior TÜSİAD Fellow and the Director of the Turkey Project. Just allow me to say very briefly that since I joined the project in 2013, January, it really has been a very enriching experience for me in all senses of the word, but including in being whipped by first Martin Indyk and then Bruce Jones to write that book. And I am really very grateful that this opportunity was given to me. Thanks to you for joining us today, and you're joining us actually just as the Turkish Prime Minister, I believe, is starting his meeting with Vice President Mike Pence, with an agenda that I hope will address that long list of grievances and problems and hopefully find a way out, build a constructive dialogue and set Turkey back on its Western vocation. I do realize that these days there are not many positive news coming out of Turkey. However, I still would like to see the quarter full, not even half, but quarter full glass. And the reason for that is U.S. decision to reintroduce some of the visa services, but also the decision on the part of the Prime Minister to come to this particular meeting on the grounds of Winston Churchill's famous saying that Joe Joe is better than War War. Just ahead of this visit, there was a debate in Turkey that the visit should only take place if the visa issue was resolved. I understand through the media that it was those who believe that dialoguing is better than not dialoguing, and that's the quarter full part of the picture out there. Before I introduce to you the panel, I still would like to make a few very quick substantive remarks. We Turks, and I hope most of us, will in less than 24 hours commemorate the legacy of the founder of the Turkish Republic passing away in 1938, just about 80 years ago. I do want to commemorate, recall his legacy because he was a leader that carried a commitment that had already been in place in the latter days of the Ottoman Empire to give Turkey its Western vocation. Atatürk was more ambitious than just that. He has that famous remark where he talked about not only catching up with contemporary civilization that then was defined as the West, but actually going beyond beyond it. Today, the picture is one where my humble opinion is that it has never been as bad as seems to be the case. Anti-Americanism is rampant. Skepticism towards the European Union has reached levels unheard of. But then, don't misunderstand me, the relationship between Turkey and the West has always had these ups and downs, as Bahadır also mentioned earlier on. However, what is ironic is that it is the political party that is right now running Turkey that brought Turkey closest to being anchored in the international liberal order and equipped Turkey with the gains that were referred to by Bruce as well as Bahadır, and equipped Turkey also with that soft power that led it being touted as a model there. However, this was not sustained, and we arrived where we are with growing authoritarianism, disregard for democratic values, and worse, the collapse of the rule of law. The drift, interestingly, has come hand in hand with these developments in Turkey. However, I would like to underline that it is not only the fault, if you wish, of the Turkish side. We have also to recognize that the West's carnet, if you wish, in French, has not been flying colors. I think many would agree with me that the cultural rejection that that Turkey felt from the European Union in the last 10 years has, I think, contributed to where we are in the relationship and where Turkey is. And also the failure to respond to the coup attempt in July 2016, at least in part to the way in which Vladimir Putin did, that failure has also not helped the confidence between the two sides. These two developments, I think, have played an important role in played into the hands of the government, and especially the ideological roots from which it comes, that has not been for a long time enthusiastic about Turkey's Western vocation, and we know the results. Yet I'd like to complete the circle by saying that this visit is a very important one, precisely because of the emphasis being put on dialoguing. But I think it's again my sense, my humble opinion, that there is growing recognition even in the ranks of the government and the political party that supports it, that to use a Turkish expression from along the Black Sea, deniz bitti. The sea has run out of water, if you wish, and that Turkey is facing very serious geopolitical, economic, political challenges, and that those challenges are much more likely to be met with a constructive relationship with the West to serve Turkey's, if it's possible to say it, objective and national interests. I'd like to conclude by a quote from retired Ambassador Jim Jeffrey, made this past July on a commemoration of the Kuwait attempt, where he said you can look it up from the video at the Washington Institute, where he said, I'm going to say something really shocking, but we could have not won the Cold War without Turkey. And he went on to say, Turkey would have not been able to protect, defend its national sovereignty without us. And today, the problems that the United States and the West faces, most of them are around Turkey, and those are the challenges that also, I think, today increasingly is being recognized, can only be addressed with the West. Very quickly now, let me introduce to you the panel. On my right is Victoria Nuland. I think many of you are very familiar with her. I need not go into the details of it. We are very honored that she is now with us at Brookings and formerly served as the Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Euro-Asia at the State Department. On my left, again, I have Amanda Sloat, and who also was at the State Department as serving as an Assistant Secretary for Deputy Assistant Secretary. I always get confused with these bureaucratic titles there. Victoria is going to say a few words about that larger picture to which already references have been made. That larger picture is not where it was in the 1990s and early 2000s that helped so much propel Turkey in the right direction, and reflect on how this is impacting on Turkish-Western relations. Amanda's focus is going to be more on the current problems and how they are playing out. And lastly, Hakan Yılmaz, my old friend and colleague from Boğaziçi University, whom we know as a leading scholar on Turkish politics, but also Turkish public opinion. He has his finger on the pulse of the Turkish public opinion, and he will reflect on how that public opinion is looking towards the West and its relationship with those universal shared values. But I'd also like to say that Hakan is not ought to be better known also for his hobby and his interest in folk music and the great poetry and songs he comes up with, for which I really would like to express my warm feelings and congratulate him, because if I was to start to sing, I think all of you would run away from the conference. With those words, I'd like to turn to Toria, and each of the panelists will respond 7-8 minutes, and then we'll move on to our debate and discussion. Toria, I'm honored to give you the floor as the moderator.
Thank you, Kamal, and thank you for Tisyad for this great partnership that we have with Brookings, which keeps us focused on our ally Turkey and our strategic relationship, as well as our shared responsibility for good governance, not only in the transatlantic space, but in the world more broadly. I'm going to start by agreeing with Jim Jeffrey. As I came up as a young diplomat, all Americans in the business had an acute understanding of the essential role that Turkey played, not only as a bulwark of security, but as an increasingly prosperous, open polity that helped us to win the global debate for liberalism, for open economies, for elected governance, for robust debate in our societies as a source of strength. So flash backwards with me to my first time serving at NATO, 2000 to 2003, which was such a time of hope with new members of NATO, new members of the EU. a robust commitment across the transatlantic space to increasing integration between Turkey and the EU, with Turkey's voice so strong and loud and respected at NATO as the flank, if you will, both literally in terms of our conventional forces, but also strategically in terms of its understanding of a part of the global challenge that some others didn't understand as well. And very, very strong American support at that time in our conversations with Europeans for keeping the doors open. Turkey had obviously joined NATO many decades before, but keeping the doors open to greater EU integration and eventual membership for Turkey. And then, interestingly, when the AKP party comes into power, much questioning in Europe. Who are these guys? What do they want? But very quickly, a strong outreach from the AKP side that what they wanted was to live in a more European way. What they wanted was to broaden the base of enfranchisement in Turkey, economically, politically, bring more Turks who hadn't benefited from Turkey's growth into the system, and to bring that dynamism, that energy to Europe, and to be welcomed as they changed the Turkish system to look more European, if they could do that, to be welcomed. And it was really a time where we were spending a lot of our energy trying to convince Europeans that this young, dynamic, energetic, hungry Turkish population could, would, should be part of the engine of growth and liberalism, not just in the transatlantic space, but globally. And that Turkey, as that hinge to the larger Middle East, also had a unique role to play in broadening the sphere of enfranchisement, human enfranchisement, government by the governed, to itself and to its east. And we were very much in partnership in that regard. Flash forward to 2008, 9, 10, disappointment, tensions over the Iraq War, the economic crisis of 2008, 2009, the rise of terrorism in our neighborhoods, the failure of the Arab Spring to bring more security, more democracy, or more openness, as both the U.S. and Turkey had hoped, EU reluctance, and perhaps Turkish slowness in finding a path together, and then, of course, the Syrian war, which tears at the fabric of all of it, and which I think both the U.S. and the EU failed to understand was an existential threat to Turkey being right on its border, and our lack of ability to form a true strategic partnership on how we would manage this crisis in a way that would bring back to the Syrian people the opportunity to live better lives. And then, of course, the coup attempt. And as Kamal and everybody else has said, the disappointment on the Turkish side with Western understanding and American understanding of that, but then concern in Europe, in Washington, about how the aftermath of the coup has been dealt with. But this is all part and parcel, as Kamal has made reference to, and as Bruce and our TUSIAD chairman has made reference to, of a larger turn away from liberalism, not simply in Turkey, but also in the United States. We now have leaders in the United States questioning freedom of the media. We have leaders in the United States questioning judicial independence. We have some calling for closing of markets. In Europe itself, in Central Europe, but in other parts of Europe, increasing questioning of whether judiciaries should be free, of whether the sovereignty that they had given to Brussels was actually paying results, an unwillingness to keep doors open to migrants and the victims of terrorism and bad governance, as Turkey has done to such a spectacular and unappreciated, I think, degree as a global leader in welcoming more than 3 million refugees. So when you see increasing pressure on the press, on human rights, on rule of law in Turkey, it is part of a larger trend, which is not to excuse it. It began before the coup. But it's a part of a larger turning away from the basic tenets that brought us the prosperity, the leadership, the security that we've enjoyed for so many decades. So the question is, I think, for all of us, for the U.S., for the EU, for the NATO countries, for Turkey, is there really an illiberal option if we want to continue to grow and prosper? Does it make sense to close our markets rather than open them? Does it make sense to put pressure on entrepreneurs and free business folks and to restatize the economy? Does it make sense to stifle the voices of change and of dissent, or is it better to have a vibrant conversation and vibrant checks and balances? Is there really an illiberal option for the United States or for Turkey or for Europe if we want to continue to benefit and grow, but most importantly, to lead the direction that this planet goes and to be that beacon, as we've always prided ourselves in being, for government by the governed, for individual human rights, for collective prosperity as a result of openness. And as Turks have prided themselves as being in terms of a gateway to a Middle East that hasn't lived as well as they have, and as an engine for a Europe that might have gotten complacent and not as innovative as it could be. So I want to vote for us coming back to our fundamental principles and us supporting each other, not just in defending liberalism and openness, but also in defending a model of prosperity and growth that depends on trade, depends on integration, depends on fighting back against far more illiberal forces in other parts of the world that we have defeated before and that are coming for us again and are trying to change the rules of the road in a way that will not benefit Americans, will not benefit Turks, and will not benefit Europeans. And that also goes to our requirement to lead in strengthening and rebuilding a Middle East where citizens have a voice, where disputes are settled at the negotiating table, and where the next generation of folks across that region really believe that they will have a say in how they are governed. And in their own futures, rather than be dominated by increasingly by going back to the future in the sense of autocracy. So I hope we make the right choices. I hope Turkey makes the right choices. But together, those of us who understand that we got stronger together as we got more open need to work hard to defend that.
Thank you, Toria. I can't help but feel that this was an inspiring set of remarks that I, of course, deeply share. But then now I have to turn to Amanda to sort of bring us back to cruel reality and how she assesses that reality with particular focus on Turkey and Turkey's relations, and maybe just a few words on how we may be able to come out from this rut and take a few steps towards the picture that Toria and us and many of us would like to see re-emerging. Thanks.
Thank you very much. It's hard enough to speak after Toria generally, but but especially with that setup, it's even harder. But very much agree with everything Toria said, who was very much a co-conspirator with me on wrestling with a lot of these issues on the U.S.-Turkey relationship during our time at the State Department. And thank you to everybody who's here. The fact that we have a standing room only event, I think, is testament to the amount of interest as well as concern in Washington, both looking at the importance of the U.S.-Turkey relationship and also having a lot of concern about where the relationship stands now. Certainly, as I used to say all the time in government, which I think is equally true now, Turkey is an important but a challenging partner. And as all of the speakers who have come before me have said, it's very clear why Turkey remains an important player within Europe, within the Middle East, and of great interest to the United States. In fact, it's very difficult to think of many problems in that region in which Turkey is not an active player and an active part of the solution to those problems. As Toria mentioned, we have the situation in Syria, where the U.S. continues to engage with Turkey on how to not only defeat ISIS, but also to work on the governance strategy, the future of Assad. What does Syria look like after ISIS is gone? Turkey obviously has a vested interest in what's happening in Iraq following the referendum in the KRG. Turkey is an important counterterrorism partner for the U.S. and especially for Europe in terms of managing the flow of foreign fighters from these battlefields into Europe. Cyprus, Turkey is an important partner to resolving that. And if we could finally get that conflict resolved, it would be wonderful for the region, especially for the prospects of NATO and EU cooperation. Turkey is also housing over 3.5 million refugees right now. And it's extraordinary if you stop and think about that number, especially when you think about some of the debates within the U.S. about refugees. 3.5 million. And I think really has done a remarkable job in terms of integrating that number of people into their society. Turkey, I think, is also facing a lot of legitimate security concerns, and I think rightly has some frustrations with the West. Toria alluded to the coup attempt last summer and a lot of the aftermath that they are continuing to deal with there. Many Turks will describe it as their 9/11, and I think are taking a lot of security precautions to ensure that similar events don't happen again. They also have very real security risk coming from their neighborhood. Decades-long conflict with the PKK, certainly very clear unhappiness with U.S. support for the YPG in Syria, given its affiliations with the PKK, and also broader challenges within the region from terrorist groups. Yet at the same time, there is growing concern, and we're seeing very similar debates within the U.S. and within the European Union about some of the domestic trends in Turkey that are more illiberal, that are drifting in an authoritarian direction. I think while there's understanding and sympathy of the crackdown following the coup, there is concern about the breadth and depth of some of these purges from government institutions, especially when the Turkish government is seen to be pursuing NGOs, human rights activists, civil society, and media representation. We're now also in the U.S. and in numerous Western European countries seeing our citizens getting caught up in this ever-expanding net, with, I think, a very flexible definition of what constitutes terrorism. And that rightly, I think, is causing a lot of concerns in our societies. And so the challenge for both of us on both sides of the Atlantic is how to respond. How do you recognize that Turkey is a very important and legitimate strategic partner, and yet at the same time, how do we respond to what we're seeing as troubling developments in a NATO ally and an EU aspirant country? In recent months, you've started to see some of these countries taking some specific steps. Germany, for example, has updated their travel advisory to warn people from Germany traveling to Turkey that there is the possibility of arbitrary arrest and potentially limited options that the German government can use to help these citizens who are caught up in this in Turkey. The German government is also looking to limit some of the state guarantees for foreign investment in Turkey. So given the tourism and the economic ties between Germany and Turkey, that's an approach that the German government is taking. within the EU as a whole, efforts to update the customs union between the EU and Turkey have been put on hold. It's something that Turkey is quite keen to have. It's something I think that would be beneficial for both sides, but that's being placed on hold right now. Also, the decision on pre-accession funding to Turkey is being decreased somewhat by the EU, but importantly, it's still being used and targeted towards civil society in Turkey, which I think all of us need to support. Finally, the U.S. has long struggled with how to respond to this as well, and I think the recent disagreement over visas certainly reflects some growing frustration here and also some consequences for some of these actions. I think the Turkish side characterizes this more as a visa spat. I think the way the State Department has characterized it is a much more legitimate response to concerns about the security of personnel at these consulate and embassy missions and a desire for some of those disagreements to get resolved. Finally, let me say a few words about the broader questions that all of this raises, which is how, in a sense, do we think about our relationship with Turkey? And I want to put forward three sort of broad brush approaches. The one and the most extreme approach is this desire that we should simply give up on Turkey. We should cut off EU accession talks. There's some very extreme arguments that maybe we should kick Turkey out of NATO, leaving aside NATO not actually having provisions to do that, but it's very much the abandoned Turkey method. And this, I think, would be the biggest mistake in terms of our approach. If you look at the debates that are happening within the EU, I think it's quite striking that two of the EU countries that actually have the most difficult relationship with Turkey right now are actually the biggest proponents of continuing the accession process, and that's Germany and Greece. We had the Greek Prime Minister Tsipras here a couple of weeks ago, and he made a passionate defense about the need for the EU to continue engaging with Turkey as a means of keeping them within this transatlantic framework. There is a risk if we end up pushing Turkey away that they're going to look for strategic partners elsewhere. And those partners, as we've seen in conversations about defense sales and about means of resolving the situation in Syria, are Russia and Iran. So if nothing else, I think we need to keep pointing Turkey in this transatlantic orientation. A second broad approach that people have started to advocate with increasing frequency on both sides of the Atlantic is to take a much more transactional approach to Turkey. Some in the EU have argued that perhaps we stop accession talks, but we simply focus with Turkey on areas where we have shared interests, economics, counterterrorism. And there's similar arguments coming out of the U.S. Personally, I'm skeptical of this approach. I'm particularly skeptical of the ability of Western countries to be able to play this game cleanly and effectively. My argument would be that rule of law needs to be a fundamental component of our dialogue. An important part of the EU accession process is this rule of law and human rights framework and a set of benchmarks that Turkey needs to meet if it is going to join the EU. If you look at disagreements between the U.S. and Turkey, especially on some of these visa and court cases, they also get to broader questions of rule of law. And so taking rule of law completely off the agenda is not a way for either of our countries to solve these problems. So finally, my third approach and my preferred approach is to continue having dialogue with Turkey, and specifically to try and expand the dialogue to include a broader set of issues. I think today's meeting between Vice President Pence and Prime Minister Yildirim is very important. I think we need to remember that our relationship is between countries, it's not between leaders. And so to the extent that we can broaden the engagement between our two countries, move beyond just our presidents to this engagement between vice presidents and prime ministers, engagement between Secretary Mattis, his counterpart, between Secretary Tillerson and his counterpart, and all the way down is extremely important. Relatedly, we need to remember the 50% of Turkish society that does not support the direction that the country is going in. And that's why I think the EU's decision to continue targeting accession funds to civil society is important. And that's why I think the United States needs to continue engaging with Turkish civil society. And finally, I think there's a role for strengthening our economic relations. And that's why I'm delighted that TÜSİAD is hosting this event, is an important partner of Brookings, and is continuing to put that message forward in both the United States and the European Union. There's tremendous capacity for stronger economic ties between our countries. And I think it's an important way to continue broadening this dialogue to make the case that some of the measures that have been introduced within Turkey are not the most hospitable to business and foreign investment, and to find ways to broaden and deepen our relations.
Thanks, Amanda. I mean, I've had a career more than 30 years in academia, and as I listened to Amanda, I kept saying, oh, I wish I could be saying what she's saying in such a structured, clear, and lucid manner. Amanda, I agree with your observations, and especially those three options and your preference for the one that prefers engagement, dialogue, and supporting and sustaining rule of law. All I'd like to add is to look back. And for Hakan and for me, who've been observing Turkey for decades, Turkey reached its peak in the numbers of people pouring into Turkey as tourists, students, business people, etc., when its democracy and rule of law was in a much better state. Turkey won a seat at the UN Security Council for the first time since early 1960s in 2008 with a huge margin, and then lost its second effort in 2014 in an embarrassing manner. So its peak of soft power was also in those days, and that sense was strongest, I think, in the neighborhood. I don't want to abuse your time and also Hakan's time. Hakan, how do you look at this debate so far? But how do the Turkish public look at this? Where do they stand themselves? And try not to be too depressing about what that picture is.
Thank you, Kemal. Thank you. It's also much harder now to talk after all these three excellent speakers. Perhaps I just want to start one remark which sort of came to my mind when I was listening to the speeches, which is to see Turkey as a problem, which Ortega y Gasset for Spain used to say that Spain is the problem, Europe is the answer. And Turkey is not a problem. Obviously, it's a country which we live in. I'm going to go back to Turkey, teach in its universities, socialize with its people. It's a tremendously creative country. It's not a problem. It's an asset for the West. It's a country with excellent companies, corporations, universities, very highly creative artists, very hospitable people. So the problem is not to see Turkey as a problem, but to see ways of reintegrating Turkey into the liberal international order or into a liberal West, which is a challenge not just for Turkey, but also for the West, as Kemal used to underline the problem, and our first speaker, Toria, used to underline the fact that the West itself was distancing from the liberal principles, and it's a challenge for both entities and not just for Turkey. So Turkey is not a geostrategic problem. It's a geostrategic, cultural, artistic, economic, military asset for the West. So it's good to keep that in mind before, you know, talking about Turkey. We're not some remote country, in one of the lost parcels of the universe. That's one thing. Second thing is, Turkish public's decision for the European Union, and that is my topic, is a yes. And it has been a yes for at least 15 years since we started to measure public opinion in a serious way. But it's a highly qualified and complicated yes. Those who are saying yes changed. The reasons for which they have been saying yes have also changed. And the interests and the emotions at which they were saying yes have also started to change. So I'm going to talk about all these three in a minute. But it is also a yes against the backdrop of historical memory of Turkey and the Ottoman Empire with the West, plus certain constants of the public opinion in Turkey with respect to Turkey's foreign relations and international context. Historically speaking, Turkey's joining the West is a yes against what we call a Sevr syndrome, which in Turkey is a core of operation, it's a modus operandi, which means that the West, since the time of the Crusaders in the 12th century onwards, have always been trying to Western countries, whether European countries, Americans included into that, have been trying to kick the Turks away from the Anatolia and the Holy Lands and give those sacred lands back to their rightful owners, whether these are the Greeks or the Armenians or the Kurds or whoever they are. So that is a syndrome in the sense that it has been very nicely codified, put into the school books and transmitted from one generation to the other. So every Turkish, you know, school child, girl or boy who studies in Turkish elementary schools learns this by heart. And when she finishes the high school, all her or his history knowledge is this Sevr syndrome and the related knowledge about it. So it's a very serious modus operandi, core of operation for Turkish population at large. And this, when we measure the public opinion in terms of various questions that are aimed to find as indicators of the Sevr syndrome, what we found out is that close to 60% of the population have been almost automatically answering our questions following the lines of this Sevr syndrome. And it's a very serious emotional impediment that determines Turkey's, at the emotional level, that is what operates, and that's what shapes Turkish EU relations. At the current level, what we have found was that there is another core of operation, which we have discovered lately with our research that we conducted almost exactly a year ago. We wanted to measure where the Turkish left and the Turkish right were diverging from one another. What were the norms, values, attitudes at which these two currents were separating from one another? What we found was the following. The single most important issue in which the Turkish nationalist right was most intensely felt was Turkey's foreign relations. Mm-hmm. The international relations of the country. Not so much domestic politics of Turkey, but as it comes to Turkey's relations with foreign countries, with the international context of Turkey, that is the area in which 70%, 80% of the population were holding to the most intensely nationalistic propositions. So that was declining when, for example, you talk about the economy or other domestic political issues, you don't see that much nationalism. But when it comes to foreign relations, this state logic, so to speak, the raison d'etat, has been very much influential in determining people's attitudes, and that includes, obviously, Turkey's relations with the West. For example, everybody, meaning 70 to 80% believes that their nation is superior to the other nations, that they would support their nation in its conflicts with other nations, no matter whether it is right or wrong. Mm-hmm. And if national interests are justifying it, it is good to interfere militarily in other nations, even if that violates international law and international agreements. So there is this great majorities who are supporting these and other statements in terms of Turkey's international relations and foreign relations. That these two operational causes, Sevr syndrome plus this foreign relations concentrated nationalism, are the emotional backgrounds against which the Turkish people are making their decisions for the European mm-hmm. Union. And that decision is a yes. Mm-hmm. It's a yes in the sense that it was around 70% of the people who would say yes to join the European Union in the early 2000s. The first time we took the poll was 2002. Today, in time, this steadily declined to around 50%. The last time we measured this was exactly this month last year. And I don't think it has changed since then. It should have increased a little bit, actually, to around, close to 60% today. That's my hunch of the public opinion. But it stays around 50%+. The reasons, the composition of the people who would say yes have also changed, interestingly. In the past, when the current government was galvanizing, mobilizing its own constituency for the cause of the European Union, and they, for this they did a great job. They mobilized the outskirts of the big cities, the small towns and villages of Anatolia, for the cause of Turkey joining the European Union. At that time, the majority of the supporters used to be more right-wing, more rural, and more religious segments of the Turkish population. In time, particularly in the last 5 to 6 years, this composition has changed. And today, the majority of this 50%+ who would support Turkey's entry into the European Union are composed of the more metropolitan, more well-educated, left-leaning or liberal left-leaning, younger, more women segments of the Turkish population. So the composition has also changed. With the composition changing, the reasons for which or the expected benefits from the European Union membership have also changed. In the past, economic benefits came at the top of the list. Today, political benefits are topping the list, particularly expectations of a better of a society based on the rule of law, democracy, those types of political and free movement in the European Union. That also has risen in the last 5 years to be almost the third reason for which people are expecting to join the European Union. If my time is up, I can stop here.
Yes, thanks, Hakan.
It's the first. I can go on talking for.
It's the first time that a panelist is offering to stop.
I was trying to squeeze myself into this 8 minutes, but I think you did.
You really did a truly grand job, especially towards the end when you compare the way in which the composition of the supporters have changed, and I think this is very significant. Time has lapsed very quickly. Rather than me asking a second round of questions to the panelists, I'd like to turn to you, to the floor, because I'm sure you have many questions and we do have a great panel here. So I look forward to receiving your questions. Anna. There's one already in the far end.
Hello, Harry Klapsis with Georgetown University. I want to ask a question about Fethullah Gulen. Obviously, it's an issue of great importance for President Erdogan. He's given evidence to the Justice Department saying that he needs to be extradited, but I think that the indication is that evidence was not enough for the U.S. government, considering that Gulen is still in the United States. So given the importance that the Turkish government places on extraditing Fethullah Gulen and the importance that the United States government places on the rule of law and ensuring that we follow the treaties that we've set with Turkey, what's a concrete path forward on resolving this issue, given no evidence on one side and the need for evidence on our side? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, please, let me take three questions around.
My name is Gökhan Kozkun. I would like to ask the question, the estimating Turkey foreign policy since last 3 years kind of little bit underestimate related based on the President Erdogan view. I would like to ask, especially for two previous U.S. Diplomats, is there any way that U.S. Can change the words or view, trying to figure out the better dialogue between Turkey as a democratic elected country person instead of using this fatter views and create a more difficult situation to connection between Turkish public and government?
Thank you. Yes, please. And then I'll have another round. Thank you.
Rosie Berman, attempting to build a career in the foreign policy space. My question is for former Ambassador Nuland. And you mentioned that the Syrian civil war is an existential threat to Turkey. And would you mind elaborating on that? Thank you.
Thank you. I'll take you in the next round. Let me turn to the U.S. diplomats, former diplomats. Sure. We must underline it, and see if you're able to respond to the question on Gulen's extradition and how to find a balance between that issue and the rule of law, as well as the question about whether a different narrative could be adopted on Turkey. And there's also the Syrian war one for you, I believe. Let's start with you, Toria.
Excellent.
Right. You're the more experienced one. So.
Amanda's, as you know, terrific Europeanist and great friend of Turkey. So I was proud to work with her in the State Department. On the Gulen issue, the issue here is that the evidence needs to persuade not the U.S. executive branch, but the U.S. judicial branch that there is a case here. Turkish government appears to be even more sure in its conviction based on its continuing to unwind intelligence information, et cetera, that there are routes back to Pennsylvania. It is a good thing that evidence is continuing to be provided to the Justice Department. But the worst thing that could happen would be for us to try to make a case but fail in the U.S. court system due to lack of evidence. So when I left government, we were trying to work together on the kinds of evidence that would be persuasive in a U.S. court. I hope that is continuing. On a better dialogue with Turkey on foreign policy, to me, it's part and parcel of the Syria question. I think it begins and ends with Syria. My personal view is that we missed an opportunity in 2012, 13, 14 to come up with a common strategic approach with Turkey, with our European allies, and with some in the Gulf on how to approach Syria as the war began to spiral. Turkish government came to us in 2013, 2014, wanted to do much more together in northern Syria. It was unclear whether we would have been able to make that deal, but I wish we had taken it more seriously because obviously we ended up in that place with the work we're now doing to the west of the Euphrates together, less aligned to the east of the Euphrates. But by that time, the situation had spiraled greatly, and we had players like Russia and Iran working for different aims that complicated the situation. So I would still hope that we could work with Turkey on a combined military and political pathway. I'd like to see a lot more emphasis on end-state diplomacy, particularly now that Raqqa has been liberated. Who is going to run Raqqa? Are they going to be in the image of the future Syria that we'd like to see? Are they going to try to demonstrate to Syrians, including those who aspire to, you know, ideas from other parts of the world as to what a peaceful democratic Syria could look like? When I talk about existential problem for Turkey, it's not just the flow of refugees. It's the fact that there was abuse of Turkish territory by those who were trying to exploit the problems in Syria, that our views of who was a terrorist and who wasn't were not always aligned either. And, you know, straight geography, if you're closest, you're going to feel it most. So I would like to see us start with that and do it better than we've done it either in the Obama administration or to date in the Trump administration.
I suspect that issue is probably being addressed right now.
Let's hope so.
And let's hope that some progress can be achieved.
Amanda, how would you respond? I suspect you're going to reflect along similar lines on to Toria on the Gulen extradition issue. That was a very good point, judiciary, executive difference there. But the question about that narrative towards Turkish democracy and coming from the United States, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, I Tori and I are like-minded on many of these issues and agree with her response. The only thing I would add on Gulen is I think the way you frame the question is right, and I think there's a risk that it's going to remain a bilateral irritant for that reason. The one thing I would add is I think there's a perception in Turkey that the U.S. is not taking this seriously, and I would disagree with that. I certainly, my sense of the way the U.S. administration, both under Obama and now under Trump, is approaching this is that there is very active and ongoing consideration within the Department of Justice of the evidence that the Turkish government has handed over, and there have been visits by teams of State Department and Justice Department lawyers to Ankara to discuss these things. So I think it should continue to be discussed, but there is a risk, as you said, that we're going to remain at this impasse. On the question of perceptions, I think that's particularly unfortunate, and I think there tends to be a lot of anti-Americanism in the Turkish media, which is also unfortunate in perpetuating some of these misunderstandings. And I think there's also a lot of frustration within Washington about things that are happening within Turkey. You certainly see this in congressional debates. You know, you can hear it at think tank events around town. And so I think, as was said by one of the earlier speakers today, there is a very high degree of mistrust between the two countries, and I think there's not always a very sufficient or in-depth understanding by both countries of what's happening. And that's why I think I would make a continued plea for dialogue and also for the U.S. to continue to try and find ways to speak to the Turkish people directly. Ambassador John Bass, in one of his last acts when he was in Ankara, for example, recorded a video on YouTube to try and get his message out directly to the Turkish public about why the U.S. had taken the actions that it did on suspending the visas. So I think that was an attempt for the U.S. government to try and get its narrative or its explanation out of why it was taking these actions to make the case that it was not directed against the Turkish people, but was being done for specific security reasons. So I think it is a challenge. I think it's an unfortunate byproduct of a lot of the mistrust that we have between these two countries. But there needs to be continued dialogue, both at the very senior levels of U.S. government and also within civil society as well.
I can't help but want to add a point to what Amanda just said, with which I agree. Part of that dialogue, I feel, also requires a freer media in Turkey so that the narratives emerging from that dialogue trickles down to the public and impacts on its public opinion. I seriously doubt that there are many, many in the Turkish public who are aware of how seriously U.S. authorities are taking the extradition request. I seriously doubt that they are aware of the visits that Amanda, you have just referred to. And this, I think, once more underlines your point towards the end of your first intervention, where you said why transactional relations would not really work, but that you need to focus on the shared values. Open society, more dialogue, and more recognition, awareness of what the real picture is, rather than the picture that is constructed on behalf of a public there. Hakan, would you like to respond to briefly, or shall I go for the second round?
I think there were enough.
Okay. Responses. We had a gentleman right in the middle who was seeking the floor, and then yes, of course you. And then we'll have right there. Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Try to be brief, so we can take one more round. Yes.
Okay. My name is Izzet Zincir, World Bank retiree. Yes, there are a lot of problems in Turkey. We read in the papers, you also talk about those problems. But I'm curious about one thing. Turkish economy this year will grow at 5%. In the next 2-3 years, 3%, 4%, maybe higher. Those numbers, growth rates, are higher than in the United States, in the whole Europe. In Europe, it runs around 2%. My question is, how can we explain this? Economy is performing better compared to some countries, but there are so many social, economic problems, political problems.
Thank you. Yeah. Many thanks. Yes, sir. Right to your right. Yeah.
Thank you. Edward Nessim, unemployed. I have a comment and a question. The first comment is we've mentioned how the relationship over the last decade has been getting worse, partly for policy reasons from the United States, the confusion in Syria, the Arab Spring, but also to do with changes, large changes in Turkey. My question is the following. What will make the present Turkish government happy? Thank you.
Ooh. Yes. Yes, please.
Thank you. Hi, Katie Lundy, Master's candidate at American University. Over the summer, I had the opportunity to work with the Turkic American Alliance in Pennsylvania and Harrisburg, and there were a few differing opinions on the coup and the legitimacy of the coup. And so I was wondering, for the perceptions between the Turkish people and the American people, if there was indeed a distinct difference between how the coup was received between our two countries. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Really great questions. Hakan has a background as an economist. He, I believe, he graduated from the Department of Economics with a flying GPA.
That was so. That was terrifying.
Well, I'm sure something is left behind. Would you be able to take the question on the economy there? I have my own opinion too that I'd like to share, but
all
I prefer to hide behind you.
Economically speaking, I think one of the most important developments over the last 15 years or so was two major developments. One was the inclusion of new classes into the mainstream economy, new entrepreneurs, new consumers, new producers that hadn't been previously in the economic sphere have made an entry into the economic sphere, and they have become rich, much richer compared to their past level of living. So, and they are the major constituency of the current government. So that's one, perhaps, major development. The other side of the picture is that the current government has established a wide network of social security that touches upon providing hospital services, health services to poorer segments of the society, which are, I believe, even better than some European societies, and particularly United States, maybe. Plus, small or medium-sized payments to, for example, to women who take care of disabled children at home, to people who were fighting, you know, in the anti-terror movement. So there are a number of payments from the government budget to the different lower segments of the society, and that also somehow included them into the economic, into the mainstream economy, and as supporters of the current government. So the current government, economically speaking, created, virtually created its economic new classes and included them into the economic mainstream. So the problem today is, obviously, these people are scared of being excluded from the economic mainstream by if the power constellation changes. So therefore, in any power constellation, any reasonable opposition would simply reiterate its commitment to keep them included. if you create even the if you create an atmosphere that if I come to power, you are going to go back to your dusty Anatolian towns and to your to the outskirts of the big cities, you are going to be impoverished, and I'm going to give my money back to the old classes, the old money people, then that type of opposition is bound to lose every single election from time, you know, to the foreseeable future. So those people have been in, and they are not. There is no way they are going to go anywhere else. And there is, and they have also made an emotional investment, as Ernesto Laclau has said, in the current government and its leader. So it's hard to sort of break up that relationship. So every opposition program and project in Turkey has to take this hard economic, political economy fact into consideration when designing its own project for political power and economic development. That's, I think.
But you didn't address the difference between 3-5%. And if I'm not an economist, and I see some economists in the audience, at the risk of being thrown tomatoes at, I'm going to argue on the heels of what just Hakan has said, bearing in mind what he's just said, that the difference between 3-5% is that the government is pumping credit into the economy to continue to maintain the people who were successfully integrated, included in to the economy. Go ahead, Hakan.
That by including certain segments, you also exclude certain other segments, and that is the political problem we have. So, and your previous economic success also becomes a hindrance for current economic growth. For example, if you grew too much on construction today, that sort of becomes an impediment for further economic growth. So you have to reinvest your resources in new economies, in new people. Sure. That means political inclusion. And that is, I think, the problem we have found ourselves in. And the problem is twofold. Not to exclude the previously included, to re-include the previously excluded. That is the political problem we have to solve, and that is a very highly complicated problem. No easy solution exists to it. The problem is, when I look at the political programs and projects of the opposition parties, they are nowhere close to solving this major, complicated, complex issue.
Yeah, very good.
So that is also a political problem. Mm-hmm. There is a political problem for which there is no political solution. Mm-hmm. As of now.
Yeah, and to be able to sustain that growth rate, Turkey needs technology and Turkey needs foreign direct investment. And that is not going to be achieved and sustained if you have the government of Germany feeling obliged to issue warnings to its citizens that also include business people, investors, engineers that are then unable to travel to Turkey and engage the Turkish economy in the direction that Hakan suggested it should be going in terms of keeping up with the massive changes, technological changes are taking place, and Bahadur made references to the fourth revolution there. We got a bit digressed, and we do have two more questions there. One is what would make the government happy in Turkey?
I'm not going to speak for the Turkish government.
Yes,
what makes it happy?
And then the good question from Harrisburg, the differences
but
of opinion.
Maybe you should
on
comment
Turkey.
On what would make the Turkish government happy.
Yes, you should do it.
He's not going to invite me back.
Yeah. I need to have had some career in diplomacy to be able to wiggle myself out of this tough question, but suggest that some of the answers might be in the book. Hakan.
Superb and shameless plug for an excellent book.
All right.
The answer is in the risk.
I'll take a risk. If I was in the shoes of the American government, which I'm not, or in the shoes of the European Union, I think I would try to start by engaging in a dialogue to encourage all sides to look in the mirror and to begin to address what were the mistakes that were made along the line and try to suggest extracting lessons for all sides, the Turkish side, but also the American and the European side, with the objective of moving forward together in a constructive way. And I would like to think and believe, go back to that quarter full glass, that hopefully today, as a meeting, may open the way towards such an exercise. It's not an easy one. I appreciate the challenges and the difficulties, but I also do think that the transatlantic community side, the US and the European Union, have a strong card. And that strong card is the fact that Turkey was doing impressively well when it was engaged with the West in a constructive way. I hope this helps. But Hakan, would you be able to very quickly respond to the differences on the coup coming from Harrisburg? How come, if I understood the question correctly, the perception of what happened in the U.S. is somewhat different than what happened in Turkey?
I mean, I think the U.S. perceptions of domestic politics of Turkey have also tainted the U.S. perceptions of the coup attempt last year, I think. And that was a tragedy, because that was a real threat, and that the Turkish government felt a life and death question for a while. And that this wasn't seen as such a big threat at least for a while, by the U.S. and European governments. And on the contrary, some theory is that the Turkish government self-staged the coup against itself. That was not well received, obviously, by the Turkish government in Turkey. So I think this should be, if I were in the shoes of the not U.S. or European Union policymakers, I think I would perhaps redress my policies in the sense of including Turkey in the European Union, for example, by opening certain chapters that call for the Turkey to reestablish rule of law, democracy, and those issues that they are about which they are now very highly critical of Turkish domestic politics. So these are going to form very productive institutional mechanisms through which there is going to be, as you said, dialogue between the two sides. And through this dialogue, they might voice their grievances, mutual grievances, agree on what they are conflicting from one another, and perhaps come to certain agreements. The only way to have this conversation is to restart, I think, the EU accession process, and for which the European Union is so much scared that any move towards Turkey would be perceived by the European populations as a concession to Turkey, and then the far right is going to rise, and then they're going to lose elections. I think this scare on the part of the European Union is preventing the European Union from using its strongest tool, its strongest instrument, for contributing to the problems for which they are criticizing Turkey. So I think that's a major problem on the part of the European Union. And in the case of Turkey, I think the EU is the major player. And the United States traditionally has supported the EU for engaging itself with Turkey. And I think that if the two powers make this type of engagement, using the EU accession mechanism for contributing to Turkish rule of law and democracy, that would be in the short term a very highly stabilizing force for the Turkish government, and I think also for the Turkish public opinion.
Yeah. That is what I thanks, thanks, Hakan. I need not say that I'm in agreement with Hakan, and that dialogue need not be only at the level of governments and leaders and ministries, but also civil society. And I think that is very pertinent to the question that was raised from Harrisburg. We've run out of time. I was really hoping to take another round, but I do want to give Toria and Amanda a quick opportunity to make closing remarks in the light of especially the discussion we just had on dialoguing the Turkish economy, et cetera.
Just very briefly and very simply to say that I agree with everything that's been said about the importance, particularly in a U.S.-Turkey context, but also the three-legged stool of Turkey, EU, and U.S. to continue to try to work through the challenges that we have, to continue to try to keep our societies open and vibrant, and to take advantage of opportunities like Prime Minister, Vice President happening at the same time as Tusiad Brookings to knit that fabric and more exchanges of young Americans to Turkey and more and young Turks to the United States in the business sector, in the nonprofit sector, and on the government side. We can't lose each other. It's too important, and neither one of us can afford to turn our back on our responsibilities as open, free societies, both in terms of the transatlantic space and globally.
Thank you, Toria. Amanda?
I don't know. I'm the final thing standing between you and your lunches. So Toria took the words out of my mouth. But I have nothing further to add.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you to you all. And thanks
to the panel. And thanks to you.